Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking 8-0 wins, 8-0 thrashings and what they both mean for Newcastle and Sheffield United. We'll also be taking a look at the other promoted teams and another dismal performance from Chelsea. Joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got two of the finest football writers in the country, Alison Rudd and Tom Allnutt, and our favourite former footballer, no, not Tony Cascarino. It's Gregor Roberts. How many times have I done that gag already?
You need
this
a new one, definitely.
Yeah, I definitely need. I know, I was panicking. I was like, need a gag. I'll do the old ex-footballer one. It's fine. Yeah, but already nearly October and I've done it at least three times. Never mind. New gags, but also new topics because we also move to North London. The big one, the most exciting, the most scintillating, the most hotly anticipated derby in Premier League history. Well, at least since the last one anyway. I want to talk about that, guys, because Alison and Tom, you were both there for us reporting on the game. Before we get into the action and what it all means, did this feel like a different type of derby? And what I mean by that is Martin Samuel, in his Sunday Times column, wrote that this was the first North London derby for a while where there wasn't a clear team in the ascendancy. It wasn't like, oh, we know how this is going to go. And so it proved the result with the 2-2 result, of course. But did it feel like that before the game? Did it feel like you had two happy sets of fans, two happy camps, Alison?
Oh, yeah, it's like being in a cult. It's ridiculous, really. I mean, they were all so ecstatic.
Now, bear in mind, you are a Liverpool fan, so don't be going too hard on the cult thing just too early.
But, there's nothing culty about Liverpool. Liverpool is what it is. It hasn't artificially manufactured it.
Let's talk about North London.
Anyway.
Shall we?
To North London.
You asked me how it felt, and it felt like I was in a cult. So, yes, Arsenal fans, deliriously happy and optimistic. The travelling fans, deliriously happy and optimistic, and the Spurs players did their thing where they go to the away fans and applaud them for being there. And there was none of that grumbling you'd get because you used to get it because emotions do get heightened for the derby. And if it doesn't pan out the way you fervently hope, then it was tangible, the distress levels. But there was none of that, actually, even though there were mistakes galore. I mean, I did sort of occasionally look on X to see what the mood was amongst the people, and there was a lot of people saying, this is the greatest North London derby for decades because the quality is so fantastic and they're both attacking teams. I didn't think the quality was that amazing. There were a lot of errors. I thought it was error strewn, in fact, and the goals were all kind of weird. They were the result of mistakes. And but the adventure from both teams was almost equal, I think. They have slightly different ways of doing it. Spurs are more chaotic than Arsenal. But that in itself led to a goal. The sense of, Kulusevski at one point was on his own on attacking down the right, and the chaos of Spurs, and he had not a single Spurs player to pass to, and he sort of gave up because he didn't know what to do, and from that point Arsenal scored. It was slight mayhem, but overall it was a pleasurable derby because it wasn't built on nastiness, and Nketiah's foul aside. It wasn't built on anger and resentment and one-upmanship. There was a sense of who's going to play the most attacking football, most attractive football. I combine those two words together.
It was beautiful. I enjoyed it. So
that made it, I suppose, in inverted commas, a special derby. But it wasn't quite the aesthetic classic that some pundits are saying.
Pleasurable mayhem then. Tom, before we get into some of the things Alison talked about, you've covered football in Spain before, some big derbies over there. How did this feel going into it? Do you agree with Alison that it was kind of two happy camps?
Yeah, two happy camps, right? I think that for a long time this has been the best fixture in the Premier League. You know, I think if you look at the kind of derbies now that we have, the City United one feels so unbalanced. Liverpool Everton has been, you know, a foregone conclusion for a long time. I think this one has delivered, even through the spells where Arsenal and Spurs have kind of been up and down, I think this singular fixture has tended to deliver pretty well. I think there was a period where, you know, early, you know, Pochettino years where it felt like Spurs are very much in the ascendancy. And then in the last 3 or 4 years with kind of the Mourinho-Conte years for Spurs, it's very much been Arsenal's kind of game. And I guess the difference for this one that it felt like you had two teams who were both prepared to kind of play attacking football, very much wanted to kind of be on the front foot. And I think the key, it felt like an even game, I felt. But at the end, the sense in the stadium was very much that Spurs were happy with the result. You know, the Arsenal fans were kind of shuffling out slightly.
Do you think so? Because I was in the office editing yesterday, and I kind of got the sense that towards the end of the game, it was Tottenham in the ascendancy. I don't know whether it was because of the nature of the way the goals were scored, but it looked to me like, oh, if one team's going to win this, it was Tottenham. But you think actually they were perhaps the happier team?
Well, I mean, I think both of those things can be true. You know, I think Spurs in the second half probably did just about look like the team who looked like they could go and win the game. I think to be fair, Arsenal as well had their moments in the last kind of 10 minutes or so. Arsenal also, you know, had a good spell. I don't think it was one of those we thought, oh, you know, Spurs really should have won the game. It was an even contest overall. But I think by the end, Tottenham came away from the game thinking, we played at the Emirates our own way. You know, we took the game to them. We had the ball. You know, had more possession for large spells of the match. Created good chances. They weren't outplayed by Arsenal. And if you kind of rewind to last year, where Spurs, for example, were playing at home, they lost 2-0 to Arsenal, and Arsenal didn't even get out of second gear. You know, they just kept the ball the whole game, and Spurs didn't even really take part in the contest. That was the bigger picture here for Tottenham. Wasn't just the result. It was, is this a Spurs team under Postecoglou who can compete with the big teams? You know, we've seen them in these kind of opening games play well and it looks promising, but when they came up against a real top team like Arsenal, could they deliver? Would the Postecoglou way survive? And even more than that, would the players kind of persevere? You know, we saw that there were some errors, they went behind twice. You know, would they get rattled and let the kind of crowd get on top of them? But they didn't, you know, and they kept playing, kept doing the things that Postecoglou wanted them to do. So I think, yes, you know, 2-2 was a good result for them, but the bigger picture for Tottenham was they feel like they're in the going in the right direction, whereas Arsenal, I think, probably think this was 2 points dropped.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, Tom, I disagree with you about the feeling that Spurs might be the ones to snatch it, because as soon as Son and Maddison went off, and the fact they went off in tandem, it just killed the vibe for them. They looked, and even though it wasn't done for this reason, it made it look like they were settling for the draw.
Hey, my mate Richarlison nearly scored. Let's not forget that super sub that he is. But lots of different strands there that I could pick up on. I want to start with Ange Postecoglou and you, Gregor, because some of the themes that Tom talked about there in his answer, sticking to a way of playing, not being afraid of big games and big occasions, these are things that you highlighted as a Celtic fan, having watched his career in the preview show. You said this is what it's going to be. He's going to stick to it. How good is it to see a manager do that and be rewarded? But I also wanted to touch on slightly his comments after the game with the handball and all armless defenders and stuff. First little glimpse of the not so always happy man, Ange. But firstly on the player side and then on the reaction.
Yeah, look, Tom's right, I think, and the thing that this said about Spurs was that they're not going to change. And, you know, we kind of knew that, but as you're saying, you're coming up against a top team and the biggest game of their season, and they sort of, they played the way that they want to play, and went toe-to-toe with Arsenal. And so that's why I think they come away from it feeling better. And I think Ange, it's funny, one of my kind of Celtic supporting friends was messaging me after this, and before this game, and saying that, like, you know, kind of Spurs fans are falling in love with Postecoglou, and you know, there's a bit of a bit of a heartache about that from Celtic's point of view.
We loved him first. But also, we loved him first.
But also, kind of, it reflects well on Celtic too if he goes there and is a success. Because every time someone goes player or manager from the SPL, from the Scottish Premiership to the Premier League, it's like there's always a question mark, a caveat about them. But we've already seen that he's a hugely talented manager, as a man manager, in terms of his personality and as a coach, and because of the way that Spurs are playing. So, like, there's no question about that. But
that reaction, then,
yeah,
like, because he also, you know, in a suit as well, he dressed up for the North London Derby for his big day. He's done lots of exasperated actions on the touchline, throwing his arms up in the air. He's meant to be Mr. Cool, Mr. Nice guy.
No, I mean, you can certainly pick up on things that he feels are, you know, when Michael Grant raised a few in his preview. There's one where Michael Beale said that he's a lucky man when he joined Rangers. He's, you know, he's a very lucky man because there's an imbalance in terms of resources. But he kept chipping away at that comment for several weeks afterwards, saying, "I'm a lucky guy," kind of, you know, kind of. So he has got that in his locker, and I think he was absolutely right. I think the handball rule is a
complete, not a pen for you.
Complete madness now, the handball rule.
Not on the rule, but not a penalty.
Well, it isn't because of the rules, but the rules are an ass. I mean, like, if you look at Anthony Gordon's in the Newcastle game, because he wasn't the player who scored the goal, but he set up someone for a tap-in, I think it was Longstaff, that doesn't count. And because Romero's arm is in an unnatural position, that the rule is crazy for me. I think that the handball law needs to be looked at desperately.
Guys, on Ange then, in the press conferences, what have you made of him so far? What did you make of him the big game, Alison?
I thought the suit was a mistake because it was a bit baggy and
tie was a bit short, wasn't it?
It didn't look great. And it did. I tell you what it looked like. It looked like he'd put a tracksuit on and his wife had said, "Hey mate, isn't this a big game?"
Yeah.
And he thought, "Oh God, all right then," and just put on some suit that hadn't been to the dry cleaners, and he'd had to take it out of the laundry basket, so it was a bit crumpled, and he hadn't worn it for 6 years, so it didn't quite fit him properly. But I don't know, adds to his quaintness maybe. I think we're still getting used to him. We're just not used to a character like this.
We still love him, just to be clear for anyone
who's
listening.
We like his difference. Yeah. We love his difference, but he does. At most pressers, he does listen to the questions, and he does pick up on something that he might find slightly insulting or slightly negative, and then throw it back at the questioner, even if it wasn't meant to be.
Or joke about it.
Yeah, in a jokey way.
And then he keeps it going. You know, he clearly doesn't. Not only would he hold a big grudge, he'll hold thousands of tiny, tiny ones as well. It's
man after my own heart.
He's fun. Get the impression he's largely honest and doesn't play games with the media, but you'd know, did he play games in Scotland? I don't know if you'd call it game playing, him referring to slights. I think that's just a way of making sure he keeps himself sharp and motivated, and reminding people that
I don't think he plays games. I think he's straight up. He's as straight up as they come. I think, as you say, he holds some kind of micro grudges, but they're not, he always does it in a sort of, you know, jokey way.
Yeah.
Like, his impact has been remarkable. I think this game underlined that.
Back to the game then. Alison, you talked about substitutions with Son and Maddison going off. I want to talk about those players shortly, but substitutions that seem pretty pivotal for me is Declan Rice going off at half-time, a substitution that flew under the radar in the office with all those games. James and I were trying to keep track, so much so that when Jorginho made the mistake, I was shouting, "Oh my God, Declan Rice in the biggest game of the season has done a massive cock." I was like, "Oh no, actually it's Jorginho. When did he go off?" Tom, you've written the news piece about Declan Rice's injury. How serious, just quickly, do we think it is?
I mean, Arteta said after the match that he's hoping it's not too serious. He did also say that it's unusual for Rice to kind of flag a back complaint, you know, during a match and come off in that kind of game. So we assume it's, you know, more than a niggle. But I guess they'll do tests today and we'll find out more.
Yeah. Do you think that change was pivotal? Because, you know, you'd imagine Rice wouldn't make that mistake. But of course, who knows? We talked before on Thursday's show, Gregor and I, with Johnny and Martin Samuel, about the idea of substituting goalkeepers and making changes and things. This felt a little bit like, to me, a bit disjointed Mikel Arteta. Not quite good tweaking, bad tweaking. Enforced tweaking, of course, But did it slightly leave Arsenal a little bit messy, it felt, in that second half?
Yeah, I think it did. And I don't think it's necessarily a coincidence after half time that the kind of mistake happened very quickly. You know, maybe Jorginho was getting to, you know, the pace of the game and wasn't quite kind of, you know, ready for the sort of the pressure that, you know, he was being put under in that situation. I mean, I think also Arsenal got a lot of injuries at the moment. There aren't many teams in the league, I don't think, who would be able to kind of resort to their third defensive midfielder and, you know, have someone better than Jorginho. I mean, you know, they're already obviously without Thomas Partey as well. So I guess you could say they're being stretched pretty thinly. I mean, I think Arsenal are at the moment looking like a team who are being experimented with a bit. You know, people are playing different positions. Nketiah and Jesus, for example, starting up front because Trossard had to pull out last minute. You know, Martinelli already injured. Some of this is kind of Arteta trying to evolve the team, you know, with David Raya, for example, and Ramsdale. But there also some of it is enforced, you know. And I mean, I think, you know, Alisson wrote a good piece about Raya as well yesterday. And I think he played well and did some great saves. But equally, he looked like someone who was also kind of getting used to the players around him. You know, his distribution wasn't perfect. He was being put under pressure. He wasn't quite as seamless, I don't think, as he was for Brentford last season. So I think we're seeing a kind of an Arsenal side who are still kind of finding their rhythm, finding their sort of fluency with each other.
Yeah, you teed me up perfectly. Alisson, why Arteta opts to play the Raya way? That was your piece of commentary and analysis from the game yesterday. Tell us more about it and what you observed.
Well, I just thought he was... Well, if, when you my task at the North London Derby was to spot a theme, so I don't really write till the end of the game. And the most eye-catching player was Raya, I thought, because there is something about the way... Most I mean, there is a trend against this, but most goalkeepers still, when they have possession of the ball, you know, they look left, right, straight ahead, and then they play around with the ball for a bit, and then they waste time, and then they think about it a bit more. He doesn't even think about it. He acts completely almost on instinct because he's surveyed where people are going to be, and so he releases the ball really quickly, which sets the tone for the whole of the attack, and it sets the tone for the team, I believe. He just wants to get things moving, and I feel that's what Arteta wants from his keeper now, is for him to be more instrumental in setting the tone of this is an attacking, aggressive team, and stressing their superiority just by him being there almost. And I agree with Tom, this wasn't his most perfect game in terms of distribution, but I've watched a lot of him. I watched a lot of him at Brentford. And it's like, you know, it's no coincidence that Brentford looked blooming awful against Everton this weekend. It's not just because Tony's not there. It wasn't just because Rico Henry was injured. It's because they are having to get to grips with not having Raya there. It's like having an extra half a player on the pitch because he does two jobs. He acts like a clever defender with his distribution, and also he's a very, very good shot stopper as well. So you're just getting more for your buck with him there on the team. And also I spoke to him about what sort of keeper he is, and he talks more than most. I mean, lots of keepers are vocal, of course, but they're vocal in a sort of warning sense, just letting defenders know they're in the wrong place or where they should be. But he actually will be vocal in terms of where he thinks players should be moving up in an attack. He's like having a coach on the pitch. Now, if you look at the way Arteta coaches from the sidelines, he's a very agitated coach, and he's constantly barking things to players, and you can sense his frustration that he can't actually physically communicate with every single one of his players. And having Raya there allows him to do that. Raya will often jog to the touchline because he's near the halfway line most of the time anyway, so he'll go to the dugout and he'll take an instruction off the manager, jog back and execute that. It's for Arteta, it's like he's got a version, you know, like a avatar of himself there on the pitch saying the things he wants to be said, sort of like a medium almost. So it's like, and I sort of concluded my piece by saying I don't believe he is going to start rotating between Ramsdale and Raya, because having Raya there is almost a status symbol. It's letting people know that Arsenal think they're ready to go the next stage and win silverware. Because if you're a big club, you don't face as many shots. You don't have to rely on someone just for their shot-stopping skills. You're not going to be as busy, and therefore, if you're not busy, earn your money by doing other things as well, which is clever and quick distribution and being vocal.
It's for Ramsdale, though. I mean, did you see his kind of exaggerated applause for when he saved Brendan Johnson's shot?
Mm. kind of no doubt he'll be like, he'll be a team player. But I wanted to, it's a subject we've talked about a lot. We discussed it. We all picked Rea if we were going to choose a goalkeeper last Monday. We then talked about substituting goalkeepers on Thursday. Tom, I want to finish this topic with you because David Rea is someone you interviewed in the summer when this move wasn't confirmed. But he talked about, I'm ready for the next step. I want silverware, as Alison said. You also wrote a piece in the Sunday Times about Arsenal potentially rotating Rea and Ramsdale. A, tell us about David Rea from what you know from meeting him. Do you agree with those characteristics that Alison picked out? And then finally, the final word on you, is he Arsenal's number one now, really?
I think it's interesting because when Arsenal signed Ramsdale, they signed him in part because they thought he was a really good character, someone who'd overcome a lot of adversity in his career. And I think you can see similar themes there with David Rea. You know, he's a lot of what he did. You know, he moved to England. You know, in his teenage years, played at Blackburn, did a loan spell in Stockport,
Southport.
That's right. Yeah. And I think they thought, wow, this guy, you know, he's gone through the kind of steps that you need to go through to kind of, you know, become a real top goalkeeper, not only technically but mentally as well. And you could tell that, you know, speaking to him last summer, he was as much as a player can do without kind of being unprofessional, agitating for the next move, you know, for the next step. And I think, you know, he was being linked with Tottenham, for example, and Spurs eventually went for Vicario, but they were very interested in him. I think Manchester United were kind of looking at him. So everyone was aware of him. And I think, you know, Arsenal also saw a market opportunity. You know, I mean, look at Manchester United signing Onana, you know, for, what was it, 70-odd million, you know. And if you have someone like David Rea who's available for 30-odd, then, you know, and you can improve your team by 10%, then of course you take that opportunity, you know. And is he a better goalkeeper than Ramsdale? Yes. Not by much, but yes, you know, and he does the things that Arsenal need him to do. The idea that you can rotate goalkeepers, I think, historically has been shown to be false. You know, I remember at Barcelona, for example, we had Ter Stegen and Claudio Bravo rotating. You know, Bravo was playing the Champions League, Ter Stegen in the league, you know, and they kind of did this dance for a year or two and they ended up hating each other. You know, and Claudio Bravo went to Manchester City and in the end everyone knew that Ter Stegen was the better goalkeeper, you know, and he is still there, you know, 5-6 years later. And I mean, there was a story with Jens Lehmann where he got subbed at half time when he was playing for Schalke, and he left the stadium early and had to get the tram home with this sort of kit on his shoulder and had to ask some stranger to pay for his tram, apparently. So it often doesn't work out. You know, goalkeepers are funny breeds. They, you know, Gregor would tell you, you know, I think that of all the kind of players and football teams, they are a certain type of character. You know, perhaps they have even bigger egos than anyone else, perhaps apart from strikers, maybe. So the idea that they can be kind of just sort of rotated and swapped in and out, I think, has been shown to be deeply flawed. And I suspect that Arteta, as Alison says, has found a way here for a relatively small amount of money to find a 10% improvement in a very key area.
So Raya's number one is what you're saying?
I think
in a very political way. Very, very articulate, very considered, but David Rea is the new number one.
I interviewed Bern Leno about this because he went through exactly the same thing when he was number one and then Ramsdale arrived. But he said before that he was almost rotating with Petr Cech, i.e. Petr Cech played slightly more than just the domestic games, he played in Europe as well. And he said he spoke to his Arsenal defenders about it, and they all said they hated it. They hated it having to cope with a new goalkeeper coming in, because you build up relationships, you get to know what they do and don't do and how they talk. So the idea, apart from the fact I think we're both agreed, Tom, that Rea is slightly the better keeper, it would make no sense to put his defence under pressure by having to deal with a new personality every 3 weeks or something. That doesn't make any sense. You just don't do that.
Absolutely. Now, I've definitely decided there, David Rea, number one goalkeeper, so cue Aaron Ramsdale's return to the Arsenal team for the next game. Gregor, I wanted to talk about a Tottenham player. The one that stood out most for me is another son of summer signing. James Maddison is a player that I actually kind of thought had slightly lost his moment with Leicester, was seen by lots of people to be kind of part of their problems, their demise, not performing well enough, got this move to Tottenham, and honestly that was one of the best performances by a newer signing in a big game early in the season that I've seen for a long time. I thought he was absolutely outstanding. What did you think about him and Tottenham? It just feels an incredibly good fit, doesn't it?
It does, and I've said numerous times on this that it's still, you know, boggles the mind that Spurs are the only team willing to pay £40 million for a guy whose numbers are as good as anyone outside the kind of maybe five players in the Premier League for throughout his whole time in the Premier League. And again, you know, produced really good numbers in a relegated team last season. It does feel like a perfect fit, and that part of that is because of this sort of this new start and this sense of like joy actually about Spurs now, and he represents that more than anyone. And another thing is, you know, the absence of Harry Kane now is hardly being felt because of a sort of new bromance between James Maddison and Son, who, you know, you thought Son would be sort of mourning the departure of Harry Kane more than anyone, and I think they've combined for 9 of Spurs' 15 goals this season. And look, you know, the playoffs play off each other so brilliantly. But Maddison's bravery and the sort of the license he has to roam, to go really deep and get on the ball. Yes, we saw him make that error for Jesus's his chance to make it 2-0. But he's done that all season. I've watched him at Bournemouth, and he was in the first few minutes dropping into kind of a space in left back sometimes because Udogie would move inside. You'll roam anywhere to get on the ball.
He also making tackles, it seems to me, a lot more, and getting stuck in, like he's nicking the ball back for the goals that they scored. Yeah. He just seems more intense about his play. There's an added verve and energy to him, whereas before he kind of gave off the vibe of the languid playmaker a bit more.
Yeah, although I mean I think that part of that is the team he's playing in and the responsibility he has to have now. After that Bournemouth game, Postecoglou made the point: it's not all about what he's doing with the ball at his feet. He's doing a lot for us out of possession as well, and you have to do that in this team because the way the Spurs play is, you know, they get so high up the pitch and they look to sustain attacks. Anytime they lose the ball, let's win it back as soon as possible. It's enormous. They're playing with enormous risk because, you know, there's the space they're leaving behind. But Maddison is a big part of that and trying to win the ball back very quickly when they lose it. And he's, you know, I think, what was that, 4 assists and 2 goals since the start of the season. He's arguably been the signing of the summer.
Alison, would you agree? Signing of the summer.
He's up there, isn't he? I think the narrative works beautifully because he fits this new version of Spurs so well. And that mistake he did make, and Jesus scored, it was a poor mistake. But you know without knowing that Postecoglou will have said to him, "Don't worry about it. You know, I'm glad you were there to receive the ball. I'm glad you're getting involved. Just keep going. I love your bravery." And when you've got the backing of a coach like that, I mean, think about it. Maddison is put up for every blooming interview, every media opportunity. He did loads of stuff before when he signed, and he just seems to be constantly popping up in newspapers and on telly. He's just always there talking about it. And there's a reason for that. The clubs don't let players speak so often unless they represent them in some way. And his enthusiasm for the project and the fact that he's new and represents the new... This is, you know, this is another version of Spurs. This is post-Harry Kane, but with a manager who, maybe coincidentally, but seems to sum up what Spurs fans think their team should be. And he's the epitome of it. So it's like feeds off itself. So the more he speaks, the more Maddison speaks about how much he's enjoying the freedom, we will buy into the fact, well, we're seeing his face all the time. He must just be the creative force, the heartbeat of the team. And it just feeds off itself, so that he has probably got now more confidence in himself than he's ever had before.
He's never lacked that, though. He always wants to be center stage.
But he's never been a brace quite this much.
Well, no, he's never played for a club like Spurs. So,
exactly. So,
but he's played in big games. He's played for England. He's played, you know, in cup finals for Leicester. He's played in big games, and he's always wanted to be center stage. But there's a difference between wanting to be center stage and actually going and being it in the North London derby. So this, you know, he's 27. He's done a lot in his career, but this was a big game for him too, because in the biggest game, he actually had one of the most telling impacts of anyone on the pitch. And you know, what Alison's saying about, you know, he represents the team. He said afterwards that Spurs are no longer Spursy. And, you know, that even that's quite
it's a big claim. Particularly in the social media age, when things get clipped up and you get embarrassed by things, as we all know on this podcast.
And particularly when actually Spurs have the same number of points as they did at this point last season.
Which leads me perfectly onto the end of this segment. I'm going to say the word Tottenham, and you're all going to say a position in the table at the end of the season. I can go first with a different voice to pretend someone's asked me the question. Tottenham, fourth. Alison?
Fifth.
Gregor?
Fourth.
Tom?
Fifth.
Fourth and fifth, Tottenham
fans.
We
were both there, so we're right.
Yes, that's true. Tottenham fans, let us know what you think on social media or get in touch with me on email tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. You can also get in touch with more ideas and suggestions for the show. We love to hear your views. And make sure you're checking out all the best of the content on the Times website, as well as Tom and Alison's pieces from the Emirates. There's also a brilliant interview with Lou Macari, and we've got reports of the sad demise of Southend. So make sure you're subscribed to check it out. And stick with us, because we're talking Chelsea, an 8-0 win next.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, you're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Chelsea fans, it's not good, is it? It's not good. Worst start in 45 years. And even worse, Gregor Robertson was there at Stamford Bridge. He's been moaning about them for months, months and months. How can they be this bad? How can they spend all this money? So what did me and James do, like the fiendish editors we are? We thought we'd send him down to see you win, surely. Aston Villa at home, it can't keep going on like this. Oh, yes, it can. 1-0, Ollie Watkins. It had it written all over it, especially with you there, Gregor. Tell us about it. Really is that bad, isn't it?
I mean, it's just remarkable to see how, I don't know, the stage fright in front of goal, the sort of the poverty of quality in the final ball. It's just remarkable to think, you know, how you can spend £1 billion and still go backwards. And basically in the space of a year. Having said all that, it was a peculiar game because, you know, you felt Aston Villa plays such a high line. We've said this many times, and it's very, you know, very risky. And the number of times Chelsea had kind of one-on-one opportunities, just simple ball in behind. Some of them were, you know, there was a late flag, but there were times where, you know, they were clean through one-on-one. Ben Chilwell, you had no confidence whatsoever he was going to finish. Raheem Sterling the same. Nicholas Jackson made one. I think he probably would have been offside. Again, very little confidence. There's just no sense when Chelsea are presented with an opportunity in front of goal that they're going to put it away.
Is that throughout the ground then? Because I asked these guys about the Emirates and the atmosphere and things. Is that on the pitch that you think the players have got no confidence? Or, you know, we've all been there in football stadiums. Are there groans and moans? Are people getting off their seat when a player's clean through? Or are they just sat there going, he's not going to
score? No, I mean, like, look, there were boos at the end of the game, but Chelsea fans are, you know, very much want this to be a success. They want the corner to be turned. But the kind of number of stats that you read about Chelsea after, you know, after every kind of result now are remarkable. It's 13 games since the turn of the year that they've drawn a blank. Three games without a goal now as well. As you said, the worst start in 45 years. Since Graham Potter was sacked in April, they've won two Premier League games against Bournemouth and Luton. Like, in 16, I think it's 18 now going back, they've won two games as well. So, like, Chelsea are a really bad team. Like, over a long period of time. It's remarkable. And again, they spent £1 billion to do this.
I would encourage you to check out Gregor's article online, because that isn't his intro. Chelsea are a really bad team. Although I would have applauded you for it. It's much more eloquent than that. But Tom, I want to come to you on Chelsea because this is your first appearance on the pod this season. We like to diversify opinions. Chelsea, a really bad team. Would you agree?
I mean, I just still can't believe Pochettino went there. You know, I just...
Really?
Pochettino, when he left PSG, everyone kind of around him was sort of saying he will never do this again. You know, he'll never join a club where there isn't a coherent strategy, where the manager isn't, you know, fully in charge, where the players signed, you know, don't match up to the kind of philosophy of the side, and yet he, in my opinion, chose the arguably the second most dysfunctional club at the moment in Europe to follow that, you know. And this isn't Pochettino's fault.
The top, surely, no.
Yeah, overtaken PSG.
Top of the league, yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, it's not Pochettino's fault, but equally, it's such a big job there to kind of sort through all these players that have come in, all these new young players. I mean, you take Jackson, for example, who Villarreal, you know, last season he had a brilliant end to the season, scored a load of goals in a very short space of time. But before that, you know, his actual kind of history of scoring and playing at that kind of level was pretty shallow, really. And if you spoke to people at Villarreal, they were kind of saying, yeah, he could be a top player, but we're not really sure because it's been such a short space of time that he's been performing like this. And it was a kind of decision for us to take this kind of money. What was it, 40 million, I think? You know, really good money for a club like Villarreal. And okay, he might end up being an 80, 90 million player, but equally, he might well not. And they were very surprised that a club like Chelsea kind of took that punt so early. And it just makes me think that all the other players they've signed, in a similar kind of way, just a lot of punts. You know, a lot of young players with big question marks. Might they be really top players in the future? Possibly. But a lot of players adjusting, you know, to the Premier League, a lot of players adjusting to a new team, to this kind of level, to a new coach. Everything is new, everything is uncertain. And the Premier League isn't a place where you can do that.
But these are all things we talked about with Graham Potter, isn't it? It's almost the same repeated. New players taking punts on young players, coach in a job that's perhaps not maybe beyond him, but certainly not what he's experienced before. And he didn't get the time. Is Pochettino going to get the time, do you think?
The history of Todd Boehly, which we don't, you know, it's not a lot, but it suggests they won't wait around. You know, I mean, I don't imagine Pochettino's going to get fired anytime soon, but it wouldn't surprise me if the pressure really cranks up before Christmas.
Martin Simon wrote that this morning. It also makes him look stupid. Todd Boehly look stupid. This is making him look very stupid.
Which is what owners do.
He wants to deflect the attention to someone else and trying to turn the corner, and that's the only way they can do it because they have invested an extraordinary amount of money in potential, as Tom's saying there. And you looked at the midfield, you know, Caicedo and Fernandes, £200 million plus players, like undoubtedly talented footballers, but they went up against Kamara and Luis, who were £25 million combined, and they were completely outshone for the whole game, like outmuscled. You know, there were times where Caicedo was trying to go in and win the ball off Douglas Luis, and like bouncing off him. And sometimes Luis was teasing him, and like we know that he's a great player, but you know, do you have to go and spend £100 million on two midfielders to improve your team?
Were there any?
I don't think you do.
Were there any bright sparks? You know, Pochettino, renowned as a good coach, obviously that's one of the reasons he was perhaps brought in. Tom, was to talk about those, you know, players, those punts. If a guy has got experience in bringing through players that are a bit of a punt, you know, you could say at Tottenham they signed a lot of players and go, they've signed him, and then he turned them into a great player. Were there any seeds of positivity, Gregor? Give Chelsea fans something to cling on to.
I'm looking at the team, and Levi Colwill, he's been impressive. Apart from that, no. They were Mudryk again. You know, it's his second start. There were flashes. He beat Cash down the line once in the first half, and whipped across flashed the ball across the box. Someone should have been on the end of that. You know, he needs something like that to come off to get a kind of a goal contribution to lift his confidence, because he still looks bereft. But half the time he's running down dark alleyways, lost possession countless times. Jackson was offside too much. As I say, they were outshone in midfield. Conor Gallagher was almost invisible, and he's wearing the captain's armband. Like, there are so many things about this. No, sorry, the brightest spark was Sanchez and goals, because without him it could have been embarrassing. You know, for all of us saying that Chelsea are creating chances and they're useless in front of goal, you looked at the end of the game, at the shot count, and it was 15-10 to Aston Villa. They had more on target as well. Aston Villa were really professional, brilliant defensively, but they were a threat on the break, and they had more chances than Chelsea. And as I say, they could have been 2 or 3 up in the first half, and Sanchez made brilliant saves at 1-0 to prevent it you know, to prevent the game being put to bed as well.
Most worrying of all, though, was that Pochettino was wearing this double-breasted navy jacket, which made him look like he was in a adaptation of an Agatha Christie. You know, the ones where there's a rich kid on a yacht.
Yeah, I don't actually,
probably,
but yeah,
and probably, I know what you mean. They're probably the murderer.
I mean, there's a lot of people look like that at Stamford Bridge too.
the Alison Rudd sartorial guide this is turning
well,
into.
I had a go at Postacoglu. Yeah, it's only fair that I have a go at Pochettino.
Yeah, tell you what, I'm glad we've got our nicest shackets on, Gregor.
No, but it was a snow, but I mean, easy to laugh, but seriously, what made him wake up and think he wanted to look like that? I mean, this is a man struggling.
Maybe
his,
it's like the Manchester
his,
United grey kit. Grey kit.
Struggling. I've never seen him wear a double-breasted navy. I mean, have you ever seen him dressed like that before?
In terms of that identity point, then taking it away from sartorial judgments, another thing he's talked about is discipline. He talked about it before the game, Gregor. A man sent off and Nicholas Jackson booked. In fact, he specifically spoke about Jackson, didn't he, before the game, saying, "You're getting booked. What are you doing? Like, you know, calm down." And then he did the same thing again. He was booked for not backing away, or
yeah, he'd been booked 4 times in 5 games, and none of them were for a foul. I think the majority were for dissent, and you know, Pochettino specifically addressed that in the press conference before the game, and obviously warned them.
Mm.
And then he didn't back off from. Emi Martinez had a free kick, you know, in the penalty box, basically, and he didn't back off the 10 yards and was booked. Now he misses a game. Gusto, I had some sympathy for Gusto because
here we go, Defenders Union. Well, I'm trying to win the ball, right?
You could see, I said it in my report. It was needless in that it was on the halfway line, on the touch line, and he didn't need to go in with such force. But it was one of those where he clipped the top of the ball, and then his force in the follow through was really, really strong, and he landed on Dinya's left ankle. And when the ref's going to sent to the screen, it's always going to be a sending off. So that did tilt, because Chelsea started the second half quite well. That did obviously tilt the game in Villa's favour. But you know, having said all that, I still think that Aston Villa had put in a really professional performance, and you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see that Chelsea lose this game. Chelsea haven't scored in 285 minutes. I said in the piece, it looked like they could have played another 285 minutes and still not found the net.
You talk in your piece about that 12th place finish last season and a slight worry over what this season might hold. I enjoyed the game with Tottenham so much that I'm going to play the same game with Chelsea, but I'm not going to ask where Chelsea are going to finish. I want to know whether you think they can finish in the top half. Gregor?
Yeah, I mean, they can finish in the top half, but you don't. Anything could happen.
Will they?
Yeah, I think they will. But you know, I said in this piece that you know, Chelsea fans will have left Stamford Bridge thinking, "Have we actually bottomed out last season?" No.
Or is it going to get
that? Was the worst season in Premier League history? They finished 12th. You know, could it be worse? It could be worse. But you know, it could also, Chelsea could get a few players back from injury. Pochettino could start to, you know, get a bit of chemistry together, and they could move up the league. But things like the top four, no chance.
Top half, Alison?
Possibly top half.
Top half, possibly. Tom?
Well, I mean, just looking at the fixtures they've got coming out. Look before December, they've got Burnley and Fulham next. Then after that, they've got Arsenal, Brentford, Spurs, City, Newcastle, Brighton and Man United. I mean, it could get a lot worse before it gets better.
Yeah.
They could have quite a long way to make
so
up.
So bottom half, then, is what you're saying.
I think they'll get top half. But just, it could get a lot worse just before Christmas.
Now time for every presenter's favourite bit on a bit of football punditry. We must talk about Aston Villa. Good win for them. And bouncing back, as Brighton did, after slightly surprising Europa League defeats. Lots of people very excited about both their seasons, and then promptly made us look very stupid on Thursday's show after talking about the strength of the English game by both losing those matches. But Villa, I mean, let's play that game. Where what does the season hold for them? Six in the table at the minute. We talked a lot about them at the very start of the season, haven't really discussed them since. Do they look all the things that an Unai Emery side look, Gregor? Well-drilled, well-organised, tough to beat?
Yes, with the caveat that this high line is pretty hairy at times.
There's the Defenders Union again.
No, I mean it is. It's like there's so many times where the ball's clipped in behind and they're just praying for the offside flag. But because of the rules now, they have to retreat and they have to do their best to try and stop a goal being scored. And that happened time and time again in this game, but it's well drilled. You know, they know what they're doing. There's times it's so risky, but their players are kind of edging up, playing that kind of thing where you're stepping up half a yard and then going back afterwards. And as I said, Luiz and Kamara were outstanding in midfield. Diaby, the pace he's added to the team, sort of dynamism up front, has been hugely important. And Watkins, you know, he's been on a bit of a kind of a run with, I think he scored 1-11 before this.
I know. Going back to last delighted, season, kept him in my fantasy football team as well. Absolutely buzzing. Hope he goes on a big run now.
It was a good, you know, it was a brilliant to reset himself after the first shot was blocked and to get the finish away. And they've got strength on the bench too. They brought in Leon Bailey, brought in Jacob Ramsey, who'd been out for a while. Duran as well has made an impact. Yuri Tielemans came on. They do, you know, they made five changes for the game in midweek, and then went back to the team that beat Palace last weekend. And this is their best team, but they have firepower up front now. So I absolutely think that they've got a chance of like competing for European spots once again.
Tom, would you agree? Unai Emery, a manager, I'm sure you've followed his career quite a lot from your time in Spain. Do you think this is a good fit for a club that are on the up, got aspirations to go into that top six contenders regularly? Is he a perfect fit for them?
Yeah, it's a great fit. I mean, you look at what Emery's done before, all his successes, you know, Sevilla, Villarreal, have come at that kind of level of club. I mean, Villa are a huge club, massive history, but in terms of where they are now, you know, they're sort of an outsider kind of top four sort of team trying to break in and win trophies. That's exactly where Emery is at. I mean, I always think these kind of games are perfect for Emery as a kind of coach. He's a meticulous planner, loves planning for an opponent and sort of an upset, likes playing against bigger teams because, you know, it's the way he likes to kind of prepare his team is very detailed analysis of, you know, how we adjust to them, that kind of thing. Where Emery's teams, I think, have historically struggled more is against the kind of lower opponents in a way. And maybe that kind of speaks to whether they even struggled in midweek, because sometimes it's when his teams need to kind of get on the front foot and play their own way and put their own stamp on a game rather than reacting to the opposition. That's when they can struggle a bit. But I think Villa look really well organised, defensively good, I think. And if Watkins can, I mean, that was a great finish, I thought. You know, it looked on TV like a sort of a real angle that maybe he shouldn't have scored from, you know, and if they can get him firing and scoring 15, 20 goals, then I think they'll be right up there.
Excellent.
Just
news.
To see to contrast the trajectories of these two clubs, though. In 2023, Chelsea have won 25 points, which is tied with Everton, bottom of teams who played last season and this season in the Premier League. And I think Villa only City have won more points, so they've been. You know, the two clubs are going in opposite directions.
Speaking of two clubs moving in opposite directions, Newcastle fans, we're finally there. An 8-0 win. I'm sure you've been listening to this whole podcast thinking, how the hell did they not start the show with an 8-0 win? For goodness sake, Martin Hardy in Sheffield for us, a destruction, plain and simple, was the intro to his piece. And I think that's fair to say we all agree with him. There's obviously so much we could talk about this game. We could pick over all the goals, the mistakes. Gregor, I'm sure we could. You've got sleepless nights over some of that defending, particularly from the set pieces, pretty abysmal. But I just want to talk about what an 8-0 win actually means in the context of football. I want to start with Newcastle. Good week for them, got a point in the Champions League against AC Milan. They go to a team where they're expected to win, and they produce a performance like this that is so ruthless. Eddie Howe making changes at the end where, you know, a bit like a boxing match, you're going, Eddie, they're done. Stop it. Leave them alone. Come on. Be nice. And he's sending on more players, sending on Isak, etc. Alisson, is this a ruthless Eddie Howe and a ruthless Newcastle who just will not stop until they're really taken seriously as a top six, top four team?
Yeah, no, I think you probably did see a bit of that glint in Eddie Howe's eyes, actually, that I doubt there's any manager of a Premier League team who actually ever feels sorry for the opponent, but occasionally you sense that the objective once the game is won is to rest players because you don't need them because you've got the game won. Think about what's coming next, and there's no particular desire to pile on the misery, but I did get the impression with Eddie Howe he wanted it to go to double figures. He could see records in front of his eyes. He could see glory and
10-0. 10-0 was what we were all thinking.
He needed 10-0 to make. He broke the record in the sense that there were eight different players on the score sheet. So yes, I did think. I think it's hurt him probably because a lot of the narrative, the start of this campaign, has been that they're going to struggle combining Europe and another assault on a top four finish. that they're nouveau riche, they haven't quite got the depth of experience to cope with elite football, and they did have a jittery patch. But they weren't embarrassed in the Champions League, and then to go from that to scoring Sackville goals, which they don't generally do. I mean, last season they were quite boring watching Newcastle. So yes, this was I saw it. I know he's got blue eyes, and blue eyes tend to look a bit more devilish, don't they, Tom Clark?
Yes, how
they do.
Dare you?
They do.
How
but dare you? I think they do. But I've got blue eyes too. But yeah, I could see he was. If anything, he was slightly cross. It was only 8-0 because it was one of those weird games where actually Sheffield United started well, did start well. You thought this was going to be a competitive match. And once they probably felt it was going against them, a couple of refereeing decisions went against them, they started to look like they're nowhere going to win it, they lost all shape completely. And I think most teams would have scored a lot of goals against them once that happened. They were more abysmal than Bournemouth were at Anfield when they lost 9-0, which is the most recent big differential I've been to. Mm. It was really bad, really, really bad. And I honestly, I think possibly Eddie Howe went to bed thinking, oh, could have been more.
It could have been more. Gregor, touching on some of Alison's themes there that she mentioned at the end with Sheffield United and Paul Heckingbottom after the game, I thought it was quite interesting in his TV interview that he talked about some of the things Alison said. We started quite well, conceded a few early goals, and then it seemed to fall apart. But he was also asked, you know, come on, Paul, this was 8-0. This is fairly disastrous. And he kind of said, well, it's only in 3 points we've only lost a game. It's only the same as losing 2-0 in that sense. We'll pick ourselves up, etc., etc. He's a manager under pressure, of course. Is he right? Or when you're in a dressing room at any level, when you've if you've lost eight, that's disastrous,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, he's putting on a brave face there. I mean, he's right, technically speaking, but the atmosphere at training today or tomorrow, if they're in tomorrow, will be like, it'll be like a morgue. And, you know, his job is to try and put that straight away in the dustbin and move on. But you're right, he is under pressure. There's even talk about Chris Wilder possibly returning before this game. I have huge sympathy for Paul Heckingbottom, though, because... Yeah. Sheffield United are a basket case.
Yeah, well, this was going to be my next point, because, again, I keep referring to our preview show because we tried to talk at length about all the teams, and this was one of the things we talked about, was you kind of... Your assessment was that they were the worst placed of all the promoted teams coming up, even, you know, worse than Luton, who everyone was like, oh, plucky Luton, this is going to be fun. But Sheffield United are... This is beyond on the pitch and beyond Paul Heckingbottom, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, they started the season and... I visited the club just before the week before the season started, and they trained. I think they had 15 fit outfield players, and four of them were kids who'd never played, academy kids. They have since made some signings. They signed Hamer, they signed Archer, they brought McAtee back from Man City, Souza the midfielder. But they all arrived a month ago. Mm. They had no time to work with them in pre-season, and even still, looking at the team and the squad, it looks light. It was a miracle that they were promoted. People think that, you know, because they came down 2 years ago, they've still got parachute payments. Mm. They had the nucleus of a squad who have played in the Premier League before. That this was some kind of, you know, it was easy, but that's nonsense. Some of the stuff that they had to deal with behind the scenes, and the lack of funds from their owner, Prince Abdullah, you know, a Saudi who seems to have no money. It was a miracle that they were promoted, and all that kind of chaos was kind of tumbled into the start of the season as well. So as there was thought, they've actually performed pretty admirably given all that. Mm. Certainly looked quite
nearly
solid.
Nearly beat Tottenham, of course. Let's remember
they looked quite solid defensively a lot of the time. Mm. They just have nothing up front. Sometimes they were hitting, you know, a lot of the goals have been like a worldie from Hamer, or they rarely hit shots on target. That seemed to be their problem. Obviously, then this comes along, and you think, where do we go next? They were, as Alison said, they were dragged around. There were huge spaces everywhere. Players looked scared to go and close anyone down because it felt like there was no cohesion. And Paul Heckingbottom said that. He said it was our organisation which started this kind of absolutely disastrous afternoon for them.
We've done a lot of looking at the table and predictions for the future, but looking at the table now, the bottom three, Luton, Burnley and Sheffield United, the three promoted teams, 1 point each. Luton getting their first point with that draw against Wolves on Saturday, which is great for them, of course, but it still does leave all three teams isolated at the bottom, which I think, thinking about it, is quite rare in recent seasons. There's normally one promoted team that has a little bit of a start and there's a little bit of hope around them. Tom, why is this? What is it that the three teams kind of performed miracles last season in the Championship, like Greg is talking about? Obviously, Burnley did very well in the Championship last season. Is this a case that
was still no mean feat as well, though?
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, people think that should have happened, but the turnover and the change of style and everything that went on,
absolutely,
are three very quite kind of unique cases. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah, is it?
Tom, what do you think? Is
it a, you know, we might have next season clubs like Leicester coming back up potentially, which might be a different case. Tom, is the gap bigger? Is it getting harder? Is it just more ruthless people like Eddie Howe just making it more difficult for you to pick up points at home? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few factors. I take the kind of macro picture about Sheffield United, but I also think it's worth saying that the defending yesterday was absolutely abysmal. Like I thought that you watch Premier League teams sometimes play against kind of, you know, League Two teams or conference sides in the FA Cup or something, and you think this is a complete mismatch. But just the kind of basic fundamentals of aggression and getting tight, following runners, will even a contest out, you know, enough. I think Sheffield United just didn't do any of those basics yesterday. And whether they got tired in the second half and just stopped doing those things, but the amount of space Newcastle players had to just pick a pass, run through, score, they were really just, you know, attacking it complete at will. I think on the wider picture, I guess, you know, it's kind of like every fairy tale seems like it has a sort of a nightmare ending. Like something like Luton, you know, it's brilliant. You know, you get up, but then you have to put up with this kind of season in the Premier League where you know, you have a really difficult year in Sheffield United as well. And I think also you have to realise that, you know, the top teams in the Premier League now are better than they've ever been. You know, that kind of top five or top six, if you like, have more money, more strength. They can hire the best coaches in the world. They can sign the best players in Europe. You know, you have... you know, Newcastle, Spurs, Brighton, these kind of teams just plucking the kind of best players from Barcelona, from Sevilla, from Juventus, whatever. And those sides, you know, have more depth and more quality than ever. So these teams that come up from the Championship, you have to be very ready for the Premier League. You know, and it feels now, and Gregor will know better than me, but it feels now that the Championship is quite well stocked with five or six quite big clubs that you might otherwise normally think would be with their resources in the Premier League, and there are perhaps three or four in the Premier League that may be the reverse. And I think they're getting some punishment from the top teams, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see three or four more results like this against Newcastle, Liverpool, City, who just have such attacking quality that they're going to put these teams to the sword.
Alison, would you agree? More of this to come potentially for this promoted three? More results like this?
Well, the problem this year, I think, is that Luton have come up expecting to go straight back down. There's no aspiration there. Haven't got the money. They haven't got the money, and the whole vibe is one of.
But they've not. They don't have the money. Have money to win promotion. Mm. They had the fourth lowest budget in the Championship. So, they absolutely have aspirations to stay in the Premier League. They just feel that they're not going to go and spend all the money that they earn from promotion in doing so. They feel that like they're going to do it the same way that they've risen from League Two,
which is nothing wrong with that, because that's good planning.
They might be wrong in a
world where we see bad management of football clubs up and down the pyramid. There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
No, and they have a bigger picture. They have a new stadium to fund. It's like, as I say, there's nothing wrong with them feeling that they can do it their way, as they say it. But the likelihood is they'll be wrong. But at least they'll be in a sound financial position to, you know, to have a successful future and a successful long term future.
Then the aspiration is to continue being.
No, but they still believe.
But I don't think they genuinely think they've got what they need to stay up.
Do you think Burnley do beating Manchester United this weekend 1-0?
No, Burnley's problem is that they think they can play the style of football they played to get out the Championship, and they can carry on playing it, and they need to be more pragmatic, I think.
But that's aspirational as well, isn't it? That's their aspiration, is to stick with it. You know, we're praising Ange Postecoglou for sticking to his methods, sticking to his guns. It's a North London derby.
But he wouldn't be allowed to do that if they weren't winning a lot of games, would they? Mm-hmm. I mean, I just feel Burnley being a little bit fantasy. I don't think they're the head in the clouds slightly. I think Luton accept that they haven't got the funding to do it. And the team I would have said was most likely to escape the drop would be Sheffield United, because I had been impressed with their stoicism and their realism and their pragmatism. They've made no attempt to be anything other than what they are and to try and be very well organised, and they've not been embarrassed by any club up until the Newcastle game. And it felt like, you know, what's going to get you out the bottom three is going to be knowing who you, understanding your limitations and being pragmatic. I still don't think it's certain they will go down, because they might well change the manager. And not that I've got anything against Heckingbottom, but sometimes, as with Bournemouth's 9-0 defeat to Liverpool, change of management just changed the mindset at the club, and they decided to use a very embarrassing moment to build and build and build. And they did. That's what they did. You can use a moment of embarrassment to get yourself out of trouble. So exactly the same could very well happen with Sheffield United, who have recent experience of the Premier League. Poorly run club, absolutely. But that, you know, that when they play well, they've got the stadium to give them backing. It's an intense atmosphere there that can get you over the line in some close games as well. So I even though they just lost 8-0, I would say I can see Sheffield United escaping more than the other two.
Bit of hope for Sheffield United fans from Alison Rudd. Lovely. That's just what we need on a Monday morning. Tom Allnutt, you mentioned fairy tales into a nightmare. Sounds just like a novel, which leads me perfectly on to the final question of the show. A nice light-hearted moment from a Sheffield United fan who, as Bruno Guimaraes celebrated Newcastle's 7th goal, the camera panned to the crowd and a Sheffield United fan was spotted getting out her book and thinking, well, sod this, I'm just going to have a little quick read. And so I wanted to know if you've ever done anything similar. Obviously, when you're working away for the Times, you're reporting, you're making notes, you're checking stats and facts. But as a fan, ever been to a game and just been so dismayed that you thought, actually, this is pretty bad? I'll go first, because being a Lincoln City fan, I definitely have. In fact, so much so that my dad, because we grew up in Manchester and we'd go to away games quite often, we'd go with some of his pals and we'd often sit in the home end of Stockport, Halifax, you know, Bury, all these clubs. And my first few games, I think I saw Lincoln lose 7-0 and 5-0, both against Stockport County. And I can remember being sat there as a young lad and my dad started sarcastically cheering, really enthusiastically. He's not a particularly, you know, emotional man. And he stood up going, yeah, go on the boys. And I was thinking, hang on, that's the wrong team. It's a very confusing lesson for a young man. So once I kind of got to 12, I was like, Dad, can we start sitting actually with the away fans? Because I'm really struggling to get my head around this. So sarcastic support is one I've been used to. But anyone ever taken a book to a game and thought, do you know what, sod this? Alison? Taking one of your own books, dished out a few of your novels to everyone?
Obviously I do that all the time, you know. Got to keep the brand going. But no, I used to take a novel when I covered Wimbledon, because it was a way of hogging a desk. So it was like the
beach. A sun lounger.
Yeah. It was putting my towel down. I actually have cycled to Wimbledon with a novel and a pot plant.
What?
And put them, and a cardigan. And a cardigan.
Very Wimbledon, isn't it?
I'm so glad I asked this question now.
I put the novel and the pot plant on the desk and laid an old cardigan that I don't mind being
Did you have the pot plant in a basket at the front of your bike?
No, because I don't cycle like that. But and then put the cardigan on the back of the chair. So I got the seat that I wanted in, which is always an overcrowded press room at Wimbledon. It's not as necessary now because you pay for a
I think you should have kept it going. The pot plant. Alison. Oh, Alison's here. Everyone walks in. Oh, Rod's here again. Bloody hell, she's bought the cactus this time. She can't be in a good mood.
Well, it was famous for a brief period that, oh, that must be Alison's desk. There but it go. Worked. I got the desk I wanted. But no, I've never taken a novel. I mean, that's why they sell programmes, isn't it? So you can bury your head in the programme when it gets too awful.
Yeah, or if they don't sell a programme, you can always subscribe to the Times app to make sure you've got it on your phone. All of Good. The best journalism.
Very nice.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Crap joke to start with. Good little link to end with. We'll leave it there. Tom Allnutt, Alison Rudd, Gregor Robson, thank you very much for joining me on this Monday. Loads to discuss. If we've not covered your team, get in touch and have a moan, and we'll make sure we'll do it on Thursday's show or in the next coming weeks. We'll be back on Thursday with Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft and Gregor, so we'll see you there.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.